If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Friday, April the 17th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, a Hoover Research Fellow and the Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism. Our guest today, coming to you via Skype from an undisclosed location somewhere in Southern California, is my friend Leo Hanian. Lee is a Hoover Institution Senior Fellow and a Professor of Economics and Director of the Edinger Family Program in Macroeconomic Research at UCLA. He's also Associate Director of the Center for the Advanced Study in Economic Efficiency at Arizona State University and a Research Associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research, where he co-directs the research initiative of macroeconomics across time and space. Lee and I also are partners in crime. We launched a project at Hoover. It was actually Lee's idea, so he gets credit for it. It's called California on Your Mind. It's one of Hoover's many web channels. He and I each write a piece each week on California. Lee focuses on economics and policy. I focus on politics and policy, and it's been a lot of fun to write. Lee, welcome back to the broadcast.
Bill, thanks for having me.
So, funny how things work out. I looked up the archives. You and I last did a podcast on April the 18th. Of last year, almost exactly 1 year to the date. And we talked about a different world because it was a different world back then. We talked about single-payer care, if Newsom was going to do this or not. We talked about the college admissions scandal. Remember that, folks. We talked about the transition from Brown to Newsom. We talked about the vexing problem with California taxation. When Jerry Brown came into office as governor in 2011, California's income tax, 53% of the personal income tax came from the top earners. First year of Gavin Newsom, it's up to 70% now, so it is shockingly top heavy. Here we are now a year later, Lee, and it's a whole new ball game in California, is it not?
Bill, it really is. All of the challenges that California faced a year ago that we discussed are still there. And now heaped on top of that, of course, is coronavirus and the fact that much of California's economy has been shuttered. Interesting statistic is that between 2010, which is when California's economy troughed from the financial crisis, and today, California added about 2.7 million jobs. Well, those jobs were obliterated just in the last month. Between mid-March and mid-April, 2.7 million California workers filed for unemployment. So we are back to where we started in 2010. And all of the troubles that we've been having in California for all these years are still there. So it's going to be a real challenge.
So Lee, the Anderson School forecast unemployment of 6.3% for California this year. I think it was 4% in January. That obviously needs to be revised. What kind of unemployment is California looking at now? Are we talking double digits as in the beginning of this last decade?
Oh, absolutely. My estimate suggests we are at about 17% or even more right now. And given that job loss is still occurring, I think we could probably see 20%, could even go over 20%. That would depend somewhat on how long the governor decides to keep much of the economy shuttered. So this is really another Great Depression. We have not seen an economic decline this large since the 1930s, when it was an entirely different world. California is going to face enormous challenges. We did have the foresight, you know, beginning with Schwarzenegger and then Brown and Newsom, there was the foresight to build up $20 billion reserve in a rainy day fund.
Right.
Between higher spending and between lower revenues, that's completely spoken for. So that cushion is effectively gone, and the governor and the state legislature are going to have to make some very, very difficult choices going forward.
Lee, when you talk about 17% unemployment, is it possible to break that down and figure how much of that is chronic versus how much of that is temporary? In other words, of that 17%, how many people would go back to work right away if they wait on tables or they work at Disneyland or they, you know, take tickets at a stadium or something like that?
Yeah. Well, before Corona hit, there were about 700,000 unemployed in California month to month. And that reflects the normal job turnover that we see.
Yep.
So this additional 2.7 is just really an enormous increase. And all of the jobs associated with crowdsourcing type activities will be slower to come back, those in which people are in are in very close contact. So even if the governor was to begin to open up the economy on May 1st, and he's indicated that he will open it up very slowly, unemployment will remain high. The best case scenario, it will be high until the summer. Worst case scenario, if corona is still a significant problem, it will remain high until the fall.
Right. So earlier this week, Governor Newsom and his counterparts in Washington and Oregon announced what they call a regional pact to recovery from COVID-19. Newsom laid out a scenario where face masks will be worn in public, restaurants will be open, but servers will have to wear gloves. Tables will be set at least 6 feet apart, which is great if you don't want to hear somebody slurping their soup. But this is going to be a huge problem for restaurants, I think, because that means they're going to be operated with far less capacity. It's going to be hard to turn a profit. You can see losers emerge immediately from this leave. For example, that shiny new football stadium down in Los Angeles. They had great plans to open it in July with Taylor Swift giving a concert. I don't see how you're going to put 70,000 people in there for a Taylor Swift concert now, so that's probably dead. But what strikes me when you hear the governor of California talk about this leave, that at all times he likes to turn to a phrase, and that phrase, Lee, is, quote, science in public health. Let me repeat that. He always wants to caution on the side of science and public health. But you're an economist, so as you look at this idea of California emerging from this, how is he going to balance science and public health versus the economy?
Bill, fantastic question. That is the key public policy question when addressing corona. Newsom, absolutely, I agree with you that Newsom is going to err on the side of caution. I think politically, and you know this as well as anybody studying California, he does not want to be known as the governor in which more Californians lost lives because of corona because he opened things up too quickly. From a business standpoint, we are in a Great Depression in California. Tax revenue is plunging, expenditures are rising. This is exacting an enormous economic toll on the 40 million people who live here. To give you an idea, 2 years ago, 100,000 people died from the flu. And no one really batted an eye over that. And there were really very few policy responses. So corona is much different than the flu. Doctors are still learning a lot about it. And I think as long as they don't know as much as they need to know, they're going to say, keep things closed. We still need time. But that is exacting an enormous economic toll. In terms of the California On Your Mind piece that we've been doing together, which has been a lot of fun for me, my column next week is going to talk about those trade-offs. And there's a sense in which we can't save everyone. And even if we tried at enormous economic cost, we just can't save everyone. So that's really a very sobering conversation Newsom has to have with his economic advisors. And that's really the main message that economics gives us, that society faces enormously important and difficult trade-offs. And this is the best example I've seen of that in many, many years.
All right. Give me a few examples, Lee, of the trade-offs that the governor will be looking at.
Well, you know, Bill, as you noted, he is going to at some point say, okay, restaurants and bars can open up, but you cannot have people closer than 6 feet apart.
Right.
Well,
right.
You know, people are going to naturally congregate closer than 6 feet. And as you noted, restaurants are not going to make a profit. At least some restaurants won't be profitable with tables 6 feet apart. There's just not the capacity to do that. They're going to be losing money. So that is going to be a difficult economic decision. Some may be able to open, but they may choose not to because they'll lose money doing it. Prices will rise. Food prices will rise. We all know that paper towel and toilet paper prices are rising enormously. So as he looks at this and he tries to open up the economy, he's going to have to understand that anything he does that tries to protect people from the virus is going to cause economic growth. And I'm not saying he's making the wrong decision now, but that is a very, very much the trade-off. And unlike the regular influenza, young people tend to be asymptomatic in response to corona. So virtually every economist I know, you know, whether they're Democrat, Republican, left or right, has the following view: that the economy should be gradually opened up. Yes, people should be wearing masks because that's low cost to do. The most high risk people, those who are elderly, those who have pre-existing conditions such as high blood pressure, cardiopulmonary issues, they should be sequestered. But that otherwise, people under 50 have, what the data shows, is that they are tend not to get sick. Some obviously do, but they do not get sick like they would with the flu. So virtually every economist I know suggests that the proposal should be get young people back to work. They will be exposed to the virus. They will develop antibodies. And once a sufficient number of people have developed antibodies, corona will not spread very much. So that's what we're looking at. But I don't think the governor is going to be doing that.
You know, Lee, when you look at the California economy, it rests on pillars, pillars of T's, as I like to say. There's the T of tourism. There's the T of trade. There is the T of technology. If the governor wanted to look at this very crassly in terms of one thing, which is money, because he needs money to come into Sacramento. Without money, he can't do his programs. If he looked at the economy, Lee, and decided where's the money going to come from in terms of starting it up, which T would you look at? Does he need to do tourism first? Does he need technology? Does he need trade? Or does he need all three at the same time?
Well, he really needs all three. He's going to have a hard time getting two of those three. Trade is really focused on the West Coast with Asia and with China. So obviously that's not going to come back very, very quickly. Tourism is not going to come back very, very quickly. People do not feel comfortable taking leisure trips. Technology is going to be less affected by those issues, but there is a Leviathan in Sacramento. There is a beast that just grabs up enormous amounts of revenue. It has an appetite that won't quit, and revenue is going to be very scarce. So there's going to be a big call for expanded taxes. And I think one of the real mistakes that the state made was to take the 13.3% emergency income surtax on the high earners and embed that as a permanent part of the tax code, because now there's only so much you can do to the golden goose. And the greatest lesson of public finance economics is you don't kill the golden goose. And California is in danger of killing the golden goose right now. So that revenue source cannot be squeezed too much more.
Right. It's also a state government, Lee, that likes to kind of put itself in a corner at times. And I'll give you a good example of this. On Wednesday, Newsom announced a $125 million public-private initiative. He calls it a disaster relief fund. $75 million comes out of the state coffers, $50 million from philanthropies. And this goes to California workers, Lee, but it goes to California workers who do not have permanent legal status, i.e. illegal immigrants, undocumented workers, whatever term you want to use. But it's going to illegal immigrants. The fund will pay Lee a one-time cash benefit of about $500 per adult, capped at $1,000 per household. So that sounds very good, Lee, until you dig a little deeper and ask, well, how many people in California need this? Well, the money covers, Lee, about 150,000 people in a state where the undocumented population is about 2.2 million. Now, obviously, that's not 2.2 million workers, but let's say half of that's a workforce. That's one-seventh of what he'll need. So here's a classic example, Lee, of the state starting down a road that they're going to have to spend and spend and spend if they want to match the need for it. So this is the trap Sacramento sets for itself constantly.
Bill, that's exactly right. The state is throwing out money like candy, and it's got to come from somewhere. And that as we talked about, that $20 billion reserve fund is literally spoken for. So yes, the state has painted itself into a corner, and they're going to have to face some very hard choices. What is going to be next month when they'll meet over the budget? And they're going to have to be a lot of cuts. There will have to be furloughs. There will have to most likely be temporary pay cuts. There just is simply no way to deal with the budget other than that. And what I worry about is that California is already one of the highest tax states in the country, and with a very inefficient tax system. We shoot ourselves in the foot every recession because, as you noted, about 70% of personal income tax revenue comes from the top 1%, and their tax payments are incredibly volatile. During good times, Steven Spielberg is reporting enormous incomes, much of it from capital gains. During bad times, people aren't taking capital gains. The stock market's down, so revenue plunges. That's really a self-inflicted wound. So what I suspect is going to happen is there's going to be enormous pressure to raise taxes. And as you and I have talked about in the past, that's probably going to be resting on businesses for property taxes. And businesses are already leaving California, which is one of the highest cost of doing business states in the country. And that would make the cost of doing business even higher.
Right. So what you're referring to is this would be revisiting Proposition 13. There's a ballot initiative. They've already collected the signatures. I don't think it's been verified yet, but they have more than enough to qualify for the ballot. So let's assume that's coming in November. We'll vote whether or not to alter Prop 13. But Lee, that would be the so-called split roll initiative, and that would affect only businesses, not residences, right?
That's exactly right. It would affect only businesses.
I think if you affected residences, you would have two things. Number one, a rebellion on your hands with people's taxes going up. And secondly, you'd probably drive a startlingly large population of the elderly population in California out of the state because their taxes, which are based maybe on 1980, projections, would be updated. They couldn't afford to live in California anymore.
No, that's exactly right. It would really be a revisit to 1978 and the original Prop 13 when taxes were rising 15-20% per year under Jerry Brown, and people cannot afford to live in their homes. What's interesting about California is that policymakers have been making these mistakes now going on 40 plus years of taxing people and businesses to death, imposing regulations that if they do any social good, the cost that they impose on the economy is a factor of 10 or 20 or 30 times higher. It just strikes me as becoming implausible that Sacramento at some point does not look at each other and say, we have to switch gears. And my hope that there's a silver lining here, which is that now that revenue is very scarce, and as the rubber hits the road, all of the pet and pork and niche projects that legislators love to talk about and love to load on become literally irrelevant. And this is becoming more of a life and death situation for people to be able to continue to live here, to survive while temporarily out of a job. I mean, this is a crisis that we have not seen really since the 1930s. So I have the hope that perhaps policymakers will see the light and say, you know what, we're part of the problem, and make some different decisions. Hope springs eternal, so we'll see what happens with that.
Yeah, I think one thing about going back to the tax situation, Lee, is this is a much more intricate dance than people realize. The Prop 13 rewrite has been talked about for a long, long time. It's gone back over a decade at least at one point. At one point, Rob Reiner, your neighbor down in Southern California, the actor, director, activist, he and the California Teachers Association cooked up a plan. They focused it. Focus grouped it. It was a disaster. They pulled away. It gets talked about in almost every cycle. Then the polling goes out. The polling doesn't show it doing very well, in part because the public sees Prop 13. They instantly think it's my house getting taxed. No, thank you. But this time it's happening. But the governor, Lee, before this was not terribly wild about this. He was hoping a legislative solution or maybe putting it off. He did not want to affix himself to it. But now, Lee, he's in a situation where he's probably going to advocate it because he needs the money. And it leads to the next shoe to drop, Lee, which is a talk about another initiative in 2022. And this would be going after one group, the wealthy. It would raise the personal income tax on the wealthiest, I think, up to 15-16%, another millionaire's tax. And this does raise a question, Lee. At what point do more millionaires say, no, thank you, California, I've had enough? They could stay in California, Lee, with a couple more points bumped up on their PIT. But at some point, a psychological factor kicks in. You just think, you know, I don't need this anymore. I'm going to Wyoming.
No, no, that's absolutely true. The classic mistake that people make, such as legislators, when they think about raising taxes on high earners is, well, they can afford to pay it. And from an economic perspective, that's not the issue. They want to make that the issue. It's not the issue whether they can afford it or not. Yes, of course they can afford it. The issue is, will they make a decision in which they will actually end up paying that tax? Or will they make decisions in which they legally live in another state? And many, many high earners have done that. So it's really an issue about the efficiency of taxation. Taxes aren't very efficient if we have to raise rates a lot, and we don't get much revenue from that. You know, Newsom has talked a lot in the past about taxing services, and that actually would be a very efficient tax, but that would hit low and moderate income people directly, and it's going to be politically unpopular. That would be a much, much better tax, even if one increased earned income tax credit types of policies within the state to try to offset some of those hits to low and middle income households. That would be a much, much better direction to go in rather than redoing Proposition 13 for businesses.
What would that service tax approach look like, Lee?
Well, it would be very much like a sales tax. And California, the share of taxes coming from sales taxes, that is the percentage, the size of the pie coming from sales taxes, has been going down over time because we've been becoming a more service-oriented economy. So as people spend a greater share of their consumer spending on services and less on goods, tax revenue from consumer spending is going down. So taxing services would restore that tax base. It's a much more stable tax base. And all things equal, I would much prefer a tax that was focused on consumption spending, provided that other taxes, such as income taxes, fell. But this is California, so that would not be very, very likely. But it would involve, say, someone goes to get a haircut. It's a $30 haircut. Well, actually, it's going to cost you $32.40 because there's an 8% tax on the haircut. So that's how it would look. But at this point, I think it's probably sufficiently politically unpopular that won't get off the ground. But that's a much better way to tax from an economic growth point of view.
So it would be sort of like the way cannabis works in California right now, where if you buy a cannabis product, there's a state tax slapped on it. And it's a big tax, by the way. Isn't it like 20% lease, something like that?
Is that right? I don't know the number. I should.
No, I think it's about 20%. It's starting high. And this has created yet another headache in California, because guess what? When you slap a 20% product on things, people don't like it. They start looking for cannabis elsewhere. So there's now a black market economy going on in California.
No, that's exactly. Yes, exactly. So all that underground activity in marijuana just, you know, it just expands, if anything.
Right. So one thing about coronavirus is winners and losers politically. And somebody who comes out pretty smart on this is somebody not given credit generally for vision. And that's George W. Bush. In 2005, Lee, he reads a book on the influenza pandemic in 1918. And he's horrified, and he directs one of his national security advisors to start a national pandemic plan. So W. was thinking around the corner. And here in California, there's another person who gets credit here. And again, somebody not generally given credit for long-term vision. And that's Arnold Schwarzenegger. And you wrote about this last week in your column, your California on Your Mind column, Coronavirus, the Cost of Progressivism. Lee, what did Arnold see back in the last decade?
So in 06, we had just had a run of a very severe flu, and Arnold was concerned about this. And he made a decision. It was a year in which revenue was coming in at a healthy pace. So politically, it was a fairly easy sell to the legislator to say, look, We've just gone through this very severe flu season. We need to make sure we have the resources and the equipment and the facilities to fight this if this should come again, and it most likely will. We can't stop it. It's out of our control. So he undertook an investment in which the state purchased millions of ventilators, enough hospital capacity that would fill 3 football fields, and these were all portable, and a lot of beds and imaging machines. And the idea was that these could go and be set up at a moment's notice where there might be a virus hotspot within the state. So it was an absolutely great idea, and it's exactly what government should be doing. The first order of government is to protect us. So this was a government investment that was a great idea. Fast forward to 2011, and Jerry Brown, the state legislature, have seen revenue drop 20%. And they have a difficult decision to make, which is, should we spend the few million dollars that we need to in order to maintain the equipment and the facilities that have already been invested? They decide not to do that. The equipment is banded. Much of it, no one knows where it even went. And now we come to 2020, and guess what? We would have loved to have those portable facilities, all of those ventilators, the imaging equipment, the other medical equipment, and suddenly California is scrambling to find ventilators. We're trying to buy them at incredibly inflated prices. Governor Newsom, who criticizes Trump every time Trump ties his shoes, suddenly is begging the president for federal help. And interestingly enough, Newsom and Trump now seem to be the best of friends since Trump really delivered for California. So this is what I call a cost of progressivism. We face these trade-offs. The governor, Brown, and the legislature could have made the decision that, yes, this by far and away is worth maintaining and spend those dollars on that.
Right.
Or they could spend the dollars on various types of pet projects and niche projects and pork. And the decision was made, and I think California's much worse off for it. We certainly would have been much better off from a dollars and cents point of view if we had maintained that stock rather than having to scramble and buy these things today.
Right. So I think this is a narrative that's going to emerge in the next year. The state has been on a spending spree through the first year of Newsom. It goes back through the second term of Jerry Brown. You know, Jerry, you know, has this image of being a miser and cheapest man in Sacramento. But if you look at the charts of spending in Sacramento, it takes off like a madman during his second term. But as we look at these numbers, Lee, what do you think is going to be the takeaway in terms of just where money went, where maybe they should have had a second thought on where they should not have spent so much?
Well, I mean, you look at California, and we are one of the highest tax states in the country. Mm-hmm. And if you compare the California of today to the California of yesteryear, when Pat Brown was governor, the state made enormous investments in schools and roads, water capacity, universities. Those were really the golden growth years of California. And today we look at schools and they're crumbling. And we look at the water supply system, and it really hasn't changed in any fundamental way since the state water project was finished in the early 1970s. I shouldn't even say finished. The final stages of the water project were never even invested in. They simply just terminated the project.
Right.
California government, it consumes revenue. The alternative decision is that it could invest that revenue in projects that would benefit citizens. But as you mentioned, there's a lot of pork being distributed. In the current budget in San Diego is Toni Atkins. Is she Senator Pro Tem, the Democratic caucus?
Yes.
Yes. I mean, hundreds of millions of state dollars are going to her district to build parks and to renovate lots of local facilities. And yourself, well, why should this state pay for issues in San Diego? It just makes no sense. Just like, why should San Diego be paying for subsidized aspects up in Eureka? The budget's loaded down with pork, and policymakers are going to have to say, look, we just cannot simply, if we tax millionaires at 16%, some of them are going to leave, and we better be pretty accurate about how many will leave and what the long run consequences of those are. So as you mentioned, Rob Reiner would probably be happy and willing to pay 15 or 16%. Many are simply going to go to Arizona or Nevada or Texas, spend 180 days here in California, and then spend their time elsewhere. There simply is a lot of avoidance of taxes that is beyond the control of the legislature and the governor. You have to realize that spending spree has to end. And their constituents, I hope, at some point, they haven't so far, but at some point, I hope their constituents, which probably are moderate income Democratic voters, will say, hey, we can't afford to live here anymore, and you need to deliver policies that make it easier for us to survive. I keep thinking that day is coming. It hasn't come, but perhaps it will now that things are so bad.
Well, you already see signs of this fraying, Lee. Go back to the March vote here. Our primary this year was early because of the presidential election. Instead of June, it was in March. There was a construction bond, a school construction bond on the ballot, Lee. Largest one in state history, $15 billion to go to school and higher ed construction. And guess what, Lee? It lost. It lost rather soundly. This is the first time, Lee, since 1994, when a couple of bonds were defeated, that a state construction bond failed. In 1994, it's my first year in California, by the way. That was a very conservative election. The three strikes measure was on the ballot. Proposition 187 was on the ballot. It was a good year for Republicans in general, California nationwide, so you could see it happening. But this went down to defeat, Lee. And I have a theory here. I've written about this for California on Your Mind. At a certain point, voters say enough. And down in Los Angeles, for example, this dovetailed with another defeat, a parcel tax measure that the LAUSD desperately wanted for schools. I'm guessing in California, Lee, that voters are just kind of getting tired of being asked. Now, there's a difference to point out here. It's one thing asking voters to vote on a measure which socks it to the rich. I think that'll still sail through in California. But I think voters being asked now to dig a little deeper for state projects, for, you know, this and that, in a good economy when there's money is flush in Sacramento, you saw a pushback this time.
You saw pushback this time. And, Bill, that's a really, really interesting point, and it's an important point, because what voters are saying when it directly hits their pocketbook, and in the past, they used to say, yes, let's improve the schools. Yes, let's improve the roads and highways. Yes, let's improve the waterways. And now they're saying no. And there's a very thin membrane between their pocketbooks being hit directly through taxes that they directly pay versus lower wages or fewer job opportunities that come about because suddenly businesses are being squeezed on their cost by higher taxes. So there's a membrane there, and that membrane is getting thinner and thinner. And at some point, I hope it's soon, that membrane will become thin enough that people say, hey, yes, you are going to tax them, but when you tax them, those businesses, that affects me, and I don't want that. So yeah. That's really there's a jump that has to be made, but I think that jump the jump is becoming narrower and narrower in terms of the gap from where people are and where they need to get to.
Yeah, Lee, we saw another fraying this week, and that is the governor's relationship with the legislature. And I've been waiting for this to come for some time because why? This is in part, I think, driven by sheer jealousy. The Governor Newsom is on television almost every day giving a briefing. Lawmakers cannot go into the state capitol, and sort of like Joe Biden back in Wilmington, Delaware, they're struggling to find ways to make news. And here's the governor just dominating the airwaves and doing one thing which has a couple of lawmakers. You see some sort of rather catty remarks coming up on Twitter where the governor goes on. He went on Rachel Maddow's show the other day on MSNBC and announced something, and a lawmaker just kind of hissed on Twitter, gee, I wish we'd been notified ahead of time. That's kind of a subtle shot across the bow saying that, you know, we're still here. Don't forget about us. And then just the other day, there's pushback coming to the governor. He has a $1 billion plan for masks. But nobody's seen the details of the plan. He won't offer them. And you're seeing lawmakers now saying, you know, we want the details of the plan. And, you know, they have to allocate the money. The governor just can't spend $1 billion on himself. He needs legislative buy-in. So you're seeing this fray, and it ties into what you alluded to earlier, the calendar of things. The May revise to the budget is coming out soon. It's a budget starting from scratch now, Lee, because every estimate that you had back in January on the economy and revenue, that's all shot to hell. So this is a rather long-winded way of saying that the governor and the legislature are going to have to sit down and figure out a way to work together. Now, this is very easy when times are flush in Sacramento, Lee. It's much easier to spend money than it is to decide where to cut. But this is the dynamic to watch in May and June going into July, just if this governor and this legislature can work together. And it ties back, Lee, to your agenda and the idea of, okay, you know, whose ox is going to get gored here.
No, absolutely right. In terms of the revenue issue, we'll see what they come up with, but when you look at major cities and you look at how those major cities are revising their revenue estimates, LA is looking at $600 million less revenue. And if anything, that is much too low. San Diego, about $250 million short. San Francisco, $750 million short. San Jose, over $100 million short. All of these estimates are 2 to 3 weeks old, so we may as well increase those anywhere between 25 to 50%. So you're absolutely right. The governor was given, you know, somewhat carte blanche by the legislature in terms of procuring medical equipment. And then they're saying, well, hey, wait a minute. You know, we need to know more about how this is taking place. Bill, you know, I've written a number of times about, you know, what I called the worst law from California in 2019, which was Assembly Bill 5, which essentially made working as an independent contractor illegal for all types of jobs except a few that were carved out, right, such as doctors and attorneys and accountants. And in an economy where millions of people have been laid off and would love to find some type of part-time work, and perhaps would love to serve their community by delivering medicine or delivering food to the elderly, what better time to allow them to work as an independent contractor and contribute to society? Well, guess what? They are prevented from doing that. Now, I and another 150 PhD economists have signed an open letter to the governor and to the state legislature requesting that AB 5 be suspended immediately so that we can get people to work delivering food, so that nurses, all including nurse anesthetists, can work as independent contractors. There are nurses sitting at home because they cannot get hired full time. And they're not allowed to work part-time as independent contractor.
Right.
That letter has now gone out to the governor and the state legislature. It is a complete no-brainer. AB 5 is an absolutely awful bill, and in my view, and virtually every economist I've talked to. And interestingly enough, he has not suspended the law yet. And the only reason I can think of is that that would be declaring war on his party, because that was really a pet bill that was union supported, which obviously is an important support of the Democratic Party. So we'll see what happens with that. But we are really shooting ourselves in the foot with some of the political decisions we're making.
Yeah. What? So this is the gig economy, Lee. What's the gig economy going to look like if we get, I hate to use this phrase, everyone's using it now, but whatever the new normal is going to look like a year from now, let's say, when California is reawoken and adjusted to this, how's the gig economy going to fit into this?
Well, gig workers are complaining that they're at risk by driving people in Uber and Lyft. We have AB 5, which is going to force all of those drivers to become full-time employees and is going to turn Uber and Lyft from software development and technology companies into taxi companies and figuring out who's going to work on Sunday at 10 a.m. We don't want Uber and Lyft to be doing that. No. We want them to continue to develop innovative software. So, Bill, I really don't know what it's going to look like a year from now. I'm hopeful that AB 5 will at some point be done and that those companies can go back working the way they have. The people I know in immunology and the virology communities suggest that when a vaccine is found for corona, it should be much more effective than for the flu, because corona will mutate much less than the flu mutates. We get these flu shots every year. We never know if they're going to be effective, because they just have to guess at the type of flu strain that's coming along. Corona, I guess, from what I understand, is a much more primitive virus. It won't mutate very much. So I'm confident we'll figure that out. What's more vexing to me is just the longer run aspects of California being really is just completely unaffordable for many, many middle income and low income families. People are leaving California. Even before Corona, California was the only state in the country to have lost jobs January over January. And that was because it lost population. California is simply unlivable. It's too expensive. It's too difficult to carve out a family. So people are leaving and predictable reasons. Right. So the long run issues are the ones I think are really going to be the ones that are going to be most important for us. And at some level, whether California survives, because pension doomsday is not all that far off, and healthcare, Medicaid doomsday is not all that far off. Those are within 5 years. Those are the things that Sacramento's got to figure out. And thus far, they've made absolutely no progress whatsoever.
Okay, Lee, final question. If you watch an old movie, there's, you know, at some point in the movie, somebody yells, "Stop the presses," and the presses stop. But the funny thing about stopping the presses, Lee, is you don't start the presses up right away. It takes hours to resume a press run. And I think an economy is very much the same way. An economy comes to a halt or a crawl like it is right now. You tell me which word is more appropriate, halt or crawl. California's economy, you just don't turn the key or press the button and it restarts. How long of a restart are we looking at, Lee? Should we be looking at this in terms of 3 or 4 months? Should we be talking about a year? Is this a multi-year thing we're looking at?
Bill, you're absolutely right. It's like the proverbial ocean liner. And a lot of it depends on what Newsom decides. If Newsom was convinced that, for example, we wave the magic wand and corona disappears, or we have a vaccine, or we have very effective treatment, things could get back to normal pretty quickly, just as they did after World War II, when there was just a huge national emergency that completely turned the economy around. But he's going to be very gradual in terms of opening things up, in terms of the restrictions and regulations that are placed on activities. Not going to have 70,000 people in a new football stadium. So, Bill, I suspect that's going to be more of 6 months to... I could certainly see this lasting at least 6 months, and perhaps a little bit more before things really get back to normal.
Okay. Lee Ohanian, I appreciate your wise words, and I really appreciate your great California on Your Mind columns every Tuesday. It's an honor to be associated with you, my friend.
Bill, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States, and for the majority of this podcast, the policy avenues available to the 40th Governor of the great state of California. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word. Get your friends to have a listen. Get them to sign up. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. And while you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for Hoover's Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Lee Ohanian and his Hoover colleagues to your inbox every weekday. And that includes California on Your Mind. As I mentioned, Lee writes on Tuesdays. I write on Thursdays. Check it out. We have a lot of fun doing it. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That is @HooverInst. Lee Ohanian, brave soul that he is on Twitter. His Twitter handle is @Lee_Ohanian. Let me repeat that. @Lee, that's L-E-E underscore Ohanian. Ohanian is spelled O-H-A-N-I-A-N. My Twitter handle, by the way, is @HooverWhalen. Whalen spelled W-H-A-L-E-N. Anything else I should plug for you, Lee?
Bill, you are my greatest advocate. Thank you.
Thank you, Lee. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. As always, thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on iTunes, iTunes U, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. I'm Chris Dower for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.